Two more.
Oh, all right. Okay, this is a session. This is part two of our discussion of Kurt Vonnegut and Mark Twain. And it's we're talking about a cycle that atheism leads to nihilism, which leads to religion, some kind of religion, which sometimes leads back to faith in Jesus Christ. And a lot of this discussion is based on a book by Robert Short, the guy who wrote The Gospel According to Peanuts and Parable of Peanuts, called Something to Believe In, subtitled as Kurt Vonnegut, The Exorcist of Jesus Christ Superstar. Actually, his real premise starts with hell. He said the reason that people like Vonnegut and Twain got really turned off to religion, not just religion in America, but to Christianity, was because of a representation of hell, a belief in a literal hell that God sends people to eternal torment because he gets angry at them. So they go about, and you have to kind of picture it as a house. The house is filled with all of this bunk. And Vonnegut describes himself as, he has a quote from his brother. His brother writes him a letter, and he says, I just had this new little baby. And it says, here I am in my life cleaning shit off of practically everything. And so Vonnegut, I don't know if that can be on the tape, it is. Anyway, Vonnegut says, that's how I see my life, as going around cleaning shit off of practically everything. And so in a way, that's what he's always doing, is he's trying to, with his humor, and sometimes it's black humor, but call things as they are. And I think for Christians, what Vonnegut does is blow the whistle on a lot of our shallow beliefs. And so they end up, Twain and Vonnegut end up cleaning up the house, okay? But the problem is they end up with an empty house. And so they try and fill things, put other things into it. So what do they substitute? We read some quotes yesterday talking about the meaninglessness of life, that both of them come to the conclusion that life is pretty meaningless. Truths are just stated by people, are fabrications, and that all truths are in fact some form of lying, that there really isn't much truth in life. And so what do you put into this empty house? And Short, reading Vonnegut and Twain, come up with about three things. The first is games or laughter. And Cat's Cradle, in the book Cat's Cradle, Dr. Hornecker, he's the creator, he's one of the scientists who's instrumental in creating the A-bomb. Well, he goes home after the bomb has exploded, and the next thing, he kind of moves from one thing to another, and the next thing he's really fascinated in is string. And while the bomb is being exploded, he has this little string that he's playing with to make cat's cradles. You know how to make a cat's cradle, the string game, for his children. And what Vonnegut is really saying is that it becomes necessary for him to be fascinated with kind of meaningless games, creativity, harmless lies, because of the pain of reality, you know, the atomic bomb exploding. There's a quote in here I wanted to read. A cat's cradle represents games, plays, dreams, harmless lies, or FOMA, those harmless truths that make you brave and kind and happy. So he says that they're very important. The other thing that they try and fill it with is laughter. And Twain talks about the importance of laughter. You mentioned The Mysterious Stranger before. And in that brief piece, The Mysterious Stranger, he says, for your race in its poverty has one really effective weapon, laughter. Against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand. And Twain uses that all the time. It's his scalpel. And Twain talks about lots of, he just gets at a lot of things by using his humor and showing the absurdity of life and some of our pretenses and our presuppositions, the way we operate. He says it's just nutty. The other thing that they try and put back in the house, they have some kind of meaning in a meaningless house, is art. And this is what Vonnegut has to say about art. He says, for Vonnegut, art is just another form of lying to ourselves. Art, he says, is to use frauds in order to make human beings seem more wonderful than they really are. Dancers are just people who go out there and act more graceful than people really are. Films, books, and plays have people talking more entertainingly than they really do, or doing really important things, and the truth is people really don't do important things. Singers make sounds far more lovely than people really make. Architects draw buildings and make them look as temples, where as though marvelous things are going on inside of them, and the truth is that people are doing worthless things inside of them. Art, he says, puts man in the center. And he says, ultimately, that's a lie. The military science, however, on the other hand, treats man as garbage. And he says, they're probably right. But he says, he urges us to deny that. He says, not only does military science treat man as garbage, they treat his cities and children and the whole society is garbage. Although Vonnegut says that's probably the truth about people, that we're really not so important. And in some places he says we're no more important than a lathe or a Chevrolet. And then he goes on, so they have other things that they want to put in the house to have meaning. So we've got laughter, creativity, and art. And then Vonnegut also suggests that there's an importance for religion in our lives. But, he says, religion is sort of a comforting lie to kind of give you something to do, something to think about. This is in another speech. I read you part of that other speech to a graduating class. This is also to a graduating class. Religion, all religion, is merely superstition. But he says it's important. It's a comforting lie. We would be a lot safer if the government would take its money out of science and put it into astrology and the reading of palms. I used to think that science would save us, and science certainly tried, but we can't stand any more tremendous explosions, either for or against democracy. Only in superstition is there hope. If you want to become a friend of civilization, then become an enemy of truth and a fanatic of harmless balderdash. I know that millions of dollars have been spent to produce this splendid graduating class, and that the main hope of your teachers was, once they got through with you, that you would no longer be superstitious. I'm sorry to have to undo that now. I beg you to believe in the most ridiculous superstition of all, that humanity is the center of the universe, the fulfiller or frustrator of the grandest dreams of God Almighty. If you can believe that and make others believe it, then there might be hope for us. Human beings might stop treating each other like garbage and might begin to treasure and protect each other instead. There's a problem in that. You can't, on the one hand, call it a lie and superstition, and on the other hand say, but you gotta believe in this. You know, that's tough. And
he's being cynical, though. It almost sounds like he believes in God. You know, this double negative type thing.
Yeah.
It comes across that way when you're reading right there.
It's hard to outguess him.
Where he's at.
But he will maintain that he is an atheist, and when Short interviews him and talks about him, he says, that stuff about there not being any atheists in foxholes, he says, I was in a foxhole, and I was an atheist. And he stayed one.
I find that passage very poignant about, it's like he really would like to believe in the worth of people, is what I hear in that, and can't find it anywhere up here to do that. So he uses that way of saying, I don't believe, but I wish I did.
Yeah.
So you believe.
Yeah. He also, it always seems like he wants to believe in God, but he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be really tickled pink if he found it out.
Yeah. And it, you know, in the book Slaughterhouse Five, I don't know if you've read that one, a lot of the things end up with the little phrase, and so it goes, and so it goes. Somebody dies, and he says, and so it goes. And, you know, it's really reminiscent of, and the book of Ecclesiastes, and everything ends up, and all is, but that is vanity too. And it's sort of a statement of the pointlessness of everything. And you have to, you put that against against Christianity and some of the promises that Jesus makes, and he says, but I am with you always, even to the close of the age. And it's very different. But Vonnegut sees in a lot of life just the pointlessness of it all.
But Ecclesiastes, isn't that, as you go towards the end of it, it leads you on, though, to see that there is some hope.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what... I tried that as morning Bible study one time, and I had no way to start the day. But, you know, there was some hope in the end of that. Where these characters, I don't know, it's a person gone very cynical. I guess I've seen a few people in my life that way. And how do you change them? They're very intelligent people gone cynical. Twain, I think, was extremely intelligent, but very cynical. Just the whole world. I guess he saw slavery, he saw misuse of religion. Of religions, I guess, or that in that middle 1850s, 1870s, turned bitter.
Yeah, they do. But they desperately want to look for meaning. You know, somebody to tell them that life has got some point to it. Life has meaning. And so very often what they'll do, you talked about, you know, Ecclesiastes starts out with, you know, the form of nihilism, very much so, and kind of ends up believing in something. And there's a lot, there's an awful lot to that pattern. Even in Matthew 24, Jesus talks about the cycle. He doesn't talk about that cycle, but listen to this text. Matthew 24, verse 9, and they will hand you over to be tortured and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Then, he says, and then many will fall away. Okay, so that's atheism. Men will betray one another and hate one another, which is, for me, where everything becomes garbage, is nihilism, where everyone turns everyone else in. In one of his books, Vonnegut talks about, and I forget, somebody comes into this guy's apartment, and he lets him use the apartment for a while, and he ends up, I think it's Cat's Cradle, and the guy ends up hanging his cat and ruining the apartment, and the fellow whose apartment it was on the verge of becoming a nihilist. But he says he just came back and saw the garbage left by this other guy and decided that that wasn't the thing for him. Anyway, okay, men would betray one another, hate one another. Then, the return of religion. Many false prophets will arise, and they will deceive many. And with the increase of lawlessness, love in most men will grow cold. Nihilism again. And then Jesus says, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there is the Christ, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and produce great signs and portents. And I think, in part, that's where we are today, after going through a period of atheism that people are really grabbing at different forms of religion, different things to put in the empty house. And one of the things that Short says is what they want to believe in God, and so maybe they thought, well, if we believe in the devil first, it's easier to believe in God. And so The Exorcist really became popular because The Exorcist was sort of a cheap way of getting at belief in God, that if the devil is real and if this little girl throws up pea soup, maybe it's easy to believe in God. And there's a lot of Christians that kind of bought into that, you know, that convert the pagans because the devil is real, then God must be real too. Which is really reading the Bible upside down, kind of. Okay. While Vonnegut says that the Bible is a pack of lies, Twain really is strong on the pack of lies. Vonnegut kind of says they're harmless lies. But a lot of his early education and why he says he is a pacifist comes from a woman by the name of Ida Young. And that's interesting. In 1973, Vonnegut talked about his pacifism. And some of it, he says, was by going through an experience being a prisoner of war in Dresden. Dresden, you know, was firebombed by the United States. And he really, Vonnegut really didn't see the point of, Dresden was not a military target, and yet we burned it to the ground kind of to get revenge on the Nazis. That was his conclusion. So he talks about this in 1973. The amazing adventures which shaped me were over by the time I was 9 years old, I'm sure. I've tried to recover some of those memories recently, and I've come up with this much anyway. The big house where I was a little kid was empty a lot of the time, except for me and a black cook named Ida Young. If it weren't for her, I wouldn't know as much about the Bible and human slavery and really poor people as I do. What a person becomes depends on his early education. I am a pacifist, and I've made my children pacifists too, but that isn't because of Dresden. It's because of the humane education I received from Ida Young. You know, and I talked yesterday a little bit about the fireman running up the stairs, putting out the fire with his disconnected hose. And that's kind of what Vonnegut does. He's a pacifist, but he gets his sensitivity and humanity from this woman. Ida Young would not see the Bible as a pack of harmless lies. It would be the farthest thing from her mind. And you know, that's where a lot of his early training comes from. There's no doubt that both Twain and Vonnegut really admire Christianity. And they talk about that. That a lot of our roots, for instance, Mark Twain says, all that is great and good in our civilization came from the hand of Jesus. And Vonnegut says he admires Christianity more than anything, especially Christianity symbolized by a group of gentle people sharing a common bowl. He really, they admire it. They're admirers of it, but not real believers. Okay, so anyway, what happens? People try, they've got an empty house of meaninglessness. We're trying to put some kind of meaning into it and find out that, you know, they chase the devils away. Vonnegut and Twain kind of chase the devils away. And then people are looking for something to believe in, and the devils kind of come in the back door again. And there's a good cartoon in here, Hagar the Horrible. You ever read that comic strip? He's talking to his son, Hamlet. Hamlet is reading a book. And so Hagar looks, he's got this big Norse guy who's got, you know, the old head with the horns on it, the helmet, I mean. He says, Hamlet, my son, book learning is okay, I guess, but it won't really help you out there in the real world with your day-to-day problems, like witches and trolls and pixies and demons. The perception of what is real. Teleki had some good stuff to say about that. He said, whoever drinks from the streams of these pseudo-absolutes is forced to move from one fountain to the next. And that, I don't know if you see that, but I really see that happening a lot. For instance, in the Kris Kristofferson, the play of football.
Semi-tough.
You remember that everybody was, all the football teams are kind of into a new, you know, everybody's into a new religion. The beat was the thing at that time, transcendental meditation. All of these vehicles, and I don't know what. Oh, pyramid power was the. Wasn't that the?
Well, it was a takeoff on Est.
Yeah. And so all of these different vehicles for sensitivity training, pseudo religions, and finally, Teleki calls them pseudo absolutes, and he said that's the bag you're gonna go from one to another, like beads on a string, and when that one doesn't satisfy, then pretty soon you're grabbing for the next one. Um, In Player Piano, Vonnegut talks about all the new religions that people are nowadays looking for to help them. Harmless magic, good old-fashioned bunkum, he calls them, but that sort of business wears thin pretty quick. The turnover is terrific, but someday, Vonnegut says, someone is going to give them something to really sink their teeth into. And again, you know, you talked before that they're on the verge, you know, it's like they want to believe in the absolutes, they'd like to believe, and they're kind of standing on the very edge. And that's why I think they're so healthy sometimes for Christians to read in their own journey through faith. I think Christianity, sometimes when we talk to other people, we're under constant pressure to water down the aspects of our faith that separate us from other people. And if you really read what the atheists, Vonnegut and Twain are saying, we'd better not water it down, because it's the stuff that they're talking about that the world really needs.
I think they heard too much, though, of Twain, too, of that, not that Jesus is love, that Jesus looks after us and takes care of us, and that he will answer our prayers, but that if you don't believe in God, you're going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they heard too much of. I think, at least with Twain, I think he heard too much of that. And that's where he got turned off or bitter. And I think sometimes this is sometimes Christians come across that way, that they pick the person up and shake them and say, you're going to hell if you don't believe.
Yeah.
Rather than the love aspect. I think that's where a lot of those guys are, just didn't get off on the right track. But
they really talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, about it's just beyond Twain how people can believe in this God who really wires people up to do the wrong thing. They both agree that, and they talk a lot about free will, that human nature is predisposed to do the evil. I think they both come to that conclusion. And they say if human beings are predisposed to do the wrong things, then who wired them up that way? God, their creator, wired them up that way. And then why does he send them to hell when they're just doing what they naturally are wired up to do? Twain talks about God setting a trap and then cutting a path through the woods so that the only place to walk is right into the trap.
That's where you wonder if Twain ever read Romans, and what Paul said. You know, if you really study Romans, that yes, we have free will with responsibilities. It's like democracy.
Yeah.
It's there if you take time to read it.
The other thing that Vonnegut argues about is, you know, he says, so God sends all of these people to burn in this unquenching lake of fire. Well, then they've certainly learned their lesson, haven't they?
Yeah.
And he says, you know, what is the point? Is that the ultimate lesson? And if people really thought that they were doing stuff here on earth that was going to send them to hell, they wouldn't really do it, would they? If you really thought that what you were doing was going to make you burn eternally, would you really do it? That doesn't make sense. So obviously, he says, people really don't believe that they're doing that stuff. And if it's just by an accident they're doing it and God's sending them to hell, what kind of sense does that make? To learn some kind of eternal lesson after they're dead? And it doesn't make any difference anyway. I entitled this session, Jesus Christ, the Chronosynclastic Infundibulum. That's
where you lost your group.
That's where I lost my group. That comes from a term in one of Vonnegut's plays, Happy Birthday, Wanda June. And he talks... He does have religion, and he comes. He belongs to a denomination of some sorts. He becomes a Unitarian, and finally he says, "Well, Unitarians don't really believe in anything, but it gives them unity." And so Vonnegut says, "I felt, and I still feel, that everybody is right, no matter what he says. I had, in fact, written a book about everybody's being right all the time, The Sirens of Titan. and I gave a name in that book to a mathematical point where all opinions, no matter how contradictory, harmonize. I call it a chronosynclastic infundibulum. He's a Vonnegut's training really is not as a literary person. He's a chemist. And so a lot of times he sees people chemically, and he says, you know, if they're fouled up. His son was a schizophrenic, by the way, became a schizophrenic, and really was able to help himself out with a lot of medication. And but Vonnegut sees people's problems or their excesses sometimes in terms of their own chemistry that's going on. Anyway, yeah, so he says that there is a point at which everybody is right. You know, the Hitlers and the Gandhis. And there's a mathematical point somewhere out in the universe where all of this stuff meets. And that, you know, in here a lot of it is all untruth of one form or another, but there's a point out in the universe where it all kind of comes together. And one can't help but think of, you know, what a lot of the New Testament has to say about Jesus Christ. Bonhoeffer wrote about Jesus, "Whoever sees Jesus Christ does indeed see the God and the world coming together in one." Vonnegut wrote a poem about Jesus on Christmas Day once, and he's drawn and fascinated by the humanity of Christ. And I want to read you that poem. It's an interesting little poem. Christmas Day, 1969. I will dream of a baby, a boy and a man, who taught simple kindness. I'll learn it if I can. I'm sorry they killed you. I'm glad you were born. I'll be a mild Christian on mild Christmas morn. He's fascinated with Jesus and some of the things that Jesus had to say. The other thing that Vonnegut gets into is the whole idea of a visitor from another planet coming here. Some of his books talk about, in one of them, somebody comes and tries to figure out why Christians who have this belief in being nice to people all the time, why they end up being so mean. But the idea of a visitor from another planet, Vonnegut is fascinated with, so that someone from the outside will tell us how to do it, because we're all so hopelessly locked into our society and our culture that we can't figure out what's true and what's right and what we ought to be doing anymore. Okay. I guess, you know, what I've tried to show is that the atheism of Vonnegut and Twain kind of leads them back to the brink of religion. And they stand admiring Jesus Christ, but they never can become a believer in him. And I'm not really sure why, and I think a lot of people are really interested in atheism and how people become atheists. I think, unfortunately, if we have to really talk about atheism, a lot of atheism comes out of the church. I think a lot of atheism is born in Sunday schools. It's interested me for a while. We really are believers in prayer, and we talk about prayer, but a lot of people don't pray. And I think the reason for that is what happens in Sunday school, is that a kid goes to Sunday school and the Sunday school teacher tells him, okay, you know, if you talk to God, if you pray to God, God will answer your prayers and he hears you. And the kid says, that's great. And he believes it. And he goes home and he wants to get a bicycle for his birthday. And he makes the mistake of praying to God for it without telling his parents. And so he prays and he doesn't get it. And he tries it a few more times. Maybe that was a fluke, you know. So he gives it a couple of other shots. And it doesn't happen. And he's disillusioned. he or she is disillusioned. And I think that really happens. I think people become disillusioned sometimes when they go away to college and they say, a lot of that stuff wasn't true that I was taught. I wonder what else wasn't true. And so we think that, you know, a lot of people go away and become atheists in college. Well, the atheism wasn't born in college. The atheism, the seeds of that atheism were planted back in Sunday school by people having bad concepts of prayer and hell, you know, and God eternally damning all of these people, you know, which if you really read through the scriptures, that's not what it says. And I think a lot of atheism is born amongst biblical literalists, people who take a lot of the things in the Bible literally, and their problem, you know, and they can quote lots of Bible passages, and so we say, well, you know, their God is in the Bible, and that's true. But I think part of their problem is they really don't know the Bible well enough. That they don't need less Bible, they need more Bible. Because they really don't understand what it's saying to us. And so, you know, to really pursue some of the themes that the Bible has to say is really important. Part of what I was trying to get at in this discussion was a way for us to talk about atheism and unbelief, disbelief. Remember, I started by talking a little bit about the difference between unbelief. Unbelief is people that just don't think about their faith a whole lot. Disbelief is someone who's pretty actively rejecting one of two things, the incarnation of Jesus Christ or some form of the Trinity, which talks about the transcendent power of God. Well, I don't know if I thoroughly bored you.
Well, to carry that one more point then, I guess our responsibility is with our children then to set a proper background in who God is and how to pray and the expected these materialistic type one-shot things. You're saying that too then, that this is the root of starting out with the very young, mm-hmm. if we don't start there. And I guess within the Lutheran Church too, that what happens to our young people in that teenage years, we're at least where we're at, we're troubled about them drifting at that point. How do we hold them together?
Yeah. I think some of the times when we lose them is in our temptation to take shortcuts early in life in terms of faith and belief. Telling people, it's really a temptation for parents, that God wants you to do this, and if you don't do that, God is going to punish you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for parents, sometimes that's a shortcut. It's an easy way to get your kids to do something. Because not only do you have yourself controlling your kids' behavior, but God, the unseen punisher. And parents, I mean, you know, we think we're out of that, but parents are still doing that. And I think that they're gardening themselves a little patch of atheism every time they do stuff like that. Yeah.
I guess I think it's a mistake. This is all off the top of my head. To assume that the natural tendency of people would be to believe, so that what we want to ask is, well, why did a person become an atheist? I think it's exactly the reverse. The astonishing thing is that people believe. To believe in a world like this, that there is a personal God, at least to believe that there's a personal God,
mm-hmm.
and that there's an incarnate God. To believe that the Bible is somehow the incarnate Word of God is a fantastic, paradoxical thing. Is not at all surprising that a thoughtful person, as perhaps Vonnegut and Twain illustrate, is an atheist. It's not that anything went wrong. person comes out of college not believing. It's that something incredible happens if they do believe.
But the problem then becomes that they pursue their atheism and come to the conclusion very often that life really has no meaning.
Okay, well, that's a sharp disjunction. There, you know, we get into lots of questions about what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If people can't see any meaning in life. But of course, people who are atheists, some see a lot of meaning in life and some see relatively little meaning in life.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole variety of them, too.
Well, when an atheism, though, turns to, and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, says that where humanism becomes sort of their religion, that what's really important is people. People are the center, and you gotta love people, and that becomes so frustrating. There was another cartoon that they referred to. You know the little cartoon strip Lolly? The boss. Lolly's boss walks in and Lolly is complaining that all he thinks about are goals and production and productivity and all of that. And Lolly's boyfriend, who's long-haired, hippie-type person, says, I don't know what he's talking about, but love is really where it's at, that you gotta love other people, and the last line is, that's why I really hate people like him. I forgot how it went, something like that. Go ahead, you were gonna
say. Well, I find more power in talking with a person who's struggling about, is there a God, and if so, how can I know that? That's much more religious or spiritual to me than talking with someone who is so rigid and can quote me Bible passages forever and doesn't have the faintest idea what they're talking about, but they know where I'm about to find it. I'm so turned off by that. And I am reluctant to claim the label Christian because so many of the Christians I know are like that. This is why I love Holden, because it's given me a whole new perspective about what religion, spirituality is about. And I value people who are quote atheists, I don't like labels. Not, I don't consider them wrong, I consider them struggling and searching.
Twain talked about heaven and hell and he said, I have friends in both places. Anyway, and I, you know, and I guess, you know, talking about your atheist friends, and I would say that's true, that I have friends in both places. But when I say both places, I'm not only referring to Jesus and God, but the other place for me is the personal hell of people who don't have anything to believe in. And when I say I have friends in both places, I'm talking about both places of having a meaning and a destiny and a purpose in life, and people who are in the hell of stewing in their own juice.
I know people who have all those things and don't ascribe all that to God.
You mean meaning?
Yeah, they have meaning and purpose and direction, and they're
mm-hmm.
kind, caring, loving people.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't feel a need to say God does that.
Yeah, so
it isn't a personal hell. I don't see all that. I know people like that.
Yeah.
Who are searching and have found nothing. But not everyone I know who doesn't believe in God feels that way.
That's sometimes a difficulty, is that you see these wonderful people who are functioning just fine without faith, and you know, that's true, and I guess I wouldn't argue with them, but very often underneath the surface for a lot of folks, you know, you don't have to scratch very far and, you know, find a real deep emptiness there too. And, you know, I really would like to engage them in a conversation about direction and meaning in life. Because I do think that you translate a lot of that over, you know, on people, and as we're losing our faith, you know, things as a society really are happening to us in our you know, this electronic stuff where I saw an article in Newsweek last week, the people with their home entertainment centers, and they just close off the environment around them and watch television, and then you go to a party and they've got this television on the people out in the patio who are having fun. And most of the people don't want to be out on the patio having fun talking with other people. They want to watch the other people talking on the television screen. And the people that walk around with the tape recorders strapped to their belts and
the radio.
And the radio. That says something to me about, you know, our turning inside of ourselves, because there's something that we're afraid of about other people, and it's just not healthy.
These people that have it all together, though, when it comes to a situation of them facing death or a loved one facing death or a crisis, I guess I've seen some of them, that's when they do come apart, but they have nothing to turn to. Death is the end. They have it all together, except they don't have eternal life. They have no hope. There's no hope beyond the grave. And that's where...
For one of my friends, that's okay?
Yeah. Well, okay, maybe it is okay. I don't know. I've seen that's the breaking point, though, with some of them. Or they'll actually break, nervous breakdowns or whatever. They just can't handle that situation. They can't cope.
Yeah, but a lot of other people cope with FOMO. I mean, they cope with the with these harmless lies, helpful lies. I mean, depending on what your point of view is on it, Vonnegut would say they're coping better, and it's because of these harmless lies. That's why he likes them.
Uh-huh. I need to understand something. You're saying that Vonnegut says that people of faith, it isn't really faith that's getting them through, it's believing in something. And even if it's a lie, it's the lie that's getting them through.
Right.
Well, there's also a question, who's the strongest? A Christian who doesn't fall apart because he or she does believe, say it's one death in an afterlife, or in some kind of meaning to that, real meaning to that death. Or the non-believer who comes partially apart at the point of death, not believing in that. I don't think the one is any stronger than the other. I don't know of any way to establish which one is stronger than the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking as a hope situation, that there it is hopeless. The situation is not completely hopeless.
For a lot of people who end up thinking a lot about death, and I know that Christianity as of late has really tried to get away from, you know, the idea that our faith is all about a divine life insurance policy, that after we die, you know, we'll get to go to heaven. And, you know, that the whole idea of Christianity for a lot of people now is the way you live. But I think ultimate, you know, listen to people like Woody Allen, that death really has an awful lot to do with the way they live and the fear of death, and they say ultimately death makes everything meaningless. They're, you know, they're interested in talking about death, and death for them, they think about it very much, really is the bottom line. And so I think sometimes Christians need to talk about ultimate meaning and the point of life and life after death is important to us, because it does give life some kind of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's partly one of the reasons Vonnegut so says that life is so meaningless. Well,
other atheists don't say that at all. I mean, you get, I guess we might call them biological types. You talk about the biological order,
mm-hmm.
in which individual mortality is a necessity, given the way evolution has to operate. And they revere the mortality of the individual instead of being frustrated by it, or despairing over it.
There's something that's good and natural.
Yes. It's a time to worship our root in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And to be grateful for the life process.
Yeah, which I guess if I had to really look at that, I'd say, well, that's fine if I'm talking about somebody else's death. But it'd make me nervous talking about my own death as...
Well, the question that comes up for them is, well, if we weren't mortal, would it really be a better life? And some of them seriously answered, no, it wouldn't at all. It'd be terrifying to live a really immortal life.
We work better under pressure.
Well, anyway, I guess, you know, this book was really provocative for me. It gave me a lot to think about. And I enjoyed reading it, as I enjoyed some of the thoughts of Vonnegut and Twain. And I wanted to see them get this in the bookstore. I hope sometime they will.
Mm-hmm.
Harper and Row. Good little book. But actually, the whole, I don't know if I told you this, the whole basis of his writing the book is to argue with Christians who believe in a literal hell. He says that is really the cause of a lot of unbelief. And he said that ultimately, he said, you have to see that Jesus reconciling the world to himself and that all things work out. And he says, well, does that make me a universalist? And he said, no, I believe in, he calls it sort of a Christian universalism, that Jesus is the reconciler. But the people that don't know it become reconciled. And as I read him, I also, some of that thought is very popular in the Roman Catholic Church right now. And I hear a lot of priests talking about that kind of... I hesitate to call it universalism, because it's not really.
It doesn't quite say every religion is of equal value. Is that why it's not?
No, yeah, he wouldn't say that. He says that Jesus, he takes a lot of New Testament passages and says that Jesus died for the sins of the world, not just for the sins of the Christians or the ones who were going to believe in him. But he reconciled the world to God. And there's lots of passages like that in the New Testament. The thing is global. As a matter of fact, you get into Romans and Paul talks about not only people, but he talks about God reconciling all of creation. And, you know, the plants and the animals, that someday the dove and the chicken hawk and the chicken are going to fly together.
What a vision.
Yeah.
I'm not just imagining the chickens fly.
That's true. Chickens fly. And he says that the reason, he believes that there's a lot of people out in the clergy that believe that secretly, but they're afraid to admit it. And they're afraid for their jobs, that if they were more secure in their jobs, they could admit it.
Tenure tracks, it's all
around. Yeah. Anyway, I wasn't quite so sure about that, but I enjoyed his discussion about you know, the meaning, atheism leading to meaninglessness and meaninglessness leading to religion. And then religion, the search for religion, putting us, you know, at the foot of the cross, on the brink of talking about Jesus Christ, our desire to see someone from another planet straighten us out, you know, the reason to love one another. It was a good book.